We've heard very many nice stories about Brains too, and their warm collaboration with various people and the strong tradition they started and maintained for so many years in here in Toronto. And hearing all these stories each time, I thought, yeah, I recognize that. That's exactly how I feel about it. And I've had the good fortune of working with Stu, and if I would have to summarize in a few sentences how I feel about that, then it's that each time I go to Stu's office to meet, or I go to my own office because he's visiting the Netherlands, I always think we're going to learn something very interesting today, and it's going to be great fun. And indeed, on every occasion, that was what happened, whether it took place in an office or whether it took place at Stu's home or at my home when I was trying to talk to Stu about polymers and he had my two kids sitting on his two knees, one left and one on the right, trying to talk Italian to them. You might think, well, why was he not trying to speak Dutch to him? Well, his German is not so good, as Enzo said, but I'm afraid his Dutch is even worse. Zwei Kaffee bitte is still possible, but twee kopjes koffie alstublieft is a little bit more different. And so Stu has actually never tried that, probably because he was afraid they were going to offer him two Dutch gins, which and he wouldn't last so long. Well, and indeed it was fun and very interesting, and that is also the case for the work I want to tell you about, which is a situation that we're trying to describe that is drawn here. We've heard a number of talks about polymers and copolymers in the vicinity of linear interfaces, so Chris and Jennifer and Enzo and Richard and Alex have been talking about this, and there's a whole theory now being developed that we really understand these problems to some extent reasonably well. And there's an interesting book by Giambattista Giacomini which is about to appear, which talks about a whole bunch of these problems, and it's fair to say that we understand a lot about this now. Now, the thing that Stu and I wanted to do is to describe a situation where we go away from a linear interface and are looking at what's happening when an interface is a bit more complex, possibly even random. And what we were trying to describe is a copolymer. We've heard about this before, so the typical example being some concatenation of hydrophobic and hydrophilic monomers. So this is, here's your polymer. You should imagine that there are these random orders of hydrophobic and hydrophilic monomers along here. And you place this in an emulsion where you have oil and water, but they do not form a flat interface. They form some sort of droplet interface like that. And the question we ask is, can we describe such a situation? Can we make mathematics out of this? And that's what we did. We came up with a mathematical model that is some sort of primitive form of describing that. This appeared in a paper that appeared in the Theoretical Probability and Applications, which was in a Festschrift for Jakob Sinai, 70th birthday. That's where you are going, Ray and Stu. And I'll tell you about that work and what it is that we managed to do. And since then, I picked this problem with Nicolas Petrelis, who's a French postdoc at URandom, and we've been trying to settle a couple of open problems that were in that paper, and I'm going to tell you about that too. So we were going to try and build a model for this copolymer in an emulsion, and well, let's see what we can do. And the idea was, well, first, the copolymer's randomness we're going to model by some random sequence of A's and B's, and A will denote that you have a hydrophobic monomer, and B will denote that you have a hydrophilic monomer, and we choose them in an IED fashion, so it means that completely randomly with equal densities, a half a half. You can play with these densities, but let's take them equal. So this models the randomness of the monomers along your copolymer. Now, what are we going to do with the emulsion? How are we going to model that? Well, having real droplets is too hard to deal with. So we thought of the following. Let's take the plane, so it's a two-dimensional problem, and let's chop the plane up into big blocks. And the size of a single block will be a number ln, and this number will become large. N will be the length of the polymer, so we will be having large blocks. So there will be a coarse graining of the space. And then every block will be chosen to be oil with probability P and water with probability 1 minus P. And we get another randomness, which is the randomness of the emulsion, which is again also denoted by A's and B's, now with probability P and 1 minus P, because playing with these densities will actually turn out to be interesting because there will be some percolation phenomenon coming up. So let me show you a picture of that. So here is my flat space, and I'm chopping it up in blocks, and they have size ln, which is going to be large. So on a microscopic scale here, there's my lattice, which I haven't drawn, and that's how I model my emulsion here. So the yellow means I have an oil block, and blue means I have a water block. Okay. So now what I have to do is I have to define what sort of paths I allow my copolymer to have. So along a path, I still have my randomness, which I haven't drawn here, but it sits on this polymer. And I have to decide which path do I allow in this oil-water percolation type medium. And lo and behold, we're going to become directed. Otherwise, we would not be able to progress very much at this stage. So we're going to consider paths that can only go up, down, and to the right. So they will be partially directed. They are self-avoiding paths. Now, if I would allow all such self-avoiding paths in this lattice, that would still be very hard. So we put in one additional restriction, which is a very unphysical restriction, but nevertheless, it's something that is vital to do. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to solve this problem. And as we will see, the model still has very, very interesting behavior. We're going to allow only paths that that have to enter and exit a pair of neighboring blocks at corners, and in particular at diagonally opposite corners. So if you enter a block here at this corner, then for a while these two neighboring blocks here are your world. You're allowed to run into this block according to your directed self-avoiding walk, but you must then, when you came in here, either go out here or go out there. So if you go out here, then again, for a while you will be seeing these two blocks. You'll be running around in them until you exit either in this corner or in that corner, and those are the set of all paths that we will allow. And why are we doing that? We're doing that because in this way we're sort of chopping up the problem. Each time you run around in a pair of blocks, you really only have to worry about that particular pair. And once you exit this pair, then there's a new world starting for you. So we do this to be able to treat the problem mathematically. So that's the set of walks that we are allow. They have to go in and out at diagonally opposite corners of these large blocks. But otherwise, they are just the good old directed self-avoiding paths. Okay, and then I have an interaction Hamiltonian, and here's a lot of here's a long formula, but basically what it says is that each match of a hydrophobic monomer in the oral gets an energetic reward minus alpha, and each match of a hydrophobic molecule so water and hydrophilic gets a reward beta, and the other gets a reward alpha. So there are no penalties if you're wrong, but you get rewards when you're right. And so this Hamiltonian is just counting whether the ith monomer is lying in a block that has the right label. So that's what the Hamiltonian does, just as in the model that Chris was explaining for the linear interface. And are these two parameters the rewards for an AA match and a reward for a BB match that we are carrying around? That you have to make a choice, so you would do the north and the east part and make a choice there, and that. But for most of what I will say, that doesn't really matter very much. Okay, and Now these parameters could be anything, but because of symmetries that there are in the problem, it's enough to look at a cone where the absolute value of beta is smaller than alpha. If you understand everything in that cone by symmetries, you understand everything in the rest of the alpha-beta plane. So, well, here's the free energy, and we're going to look at this problem quenched. So quenched both with respect to the randomness along the copolymer and the oil and the water in the plane. And the free energy is defined as usual. You have your Hamiltonian, then you have a Gibbs weight. So the probability of a path is e to the minus it's Hamiltonian. And then you have a partition function here, and the free energy for a finite polymer is given by this. And what we're going to do now is going to take the thermodynamic limit. We're going to let the polymer become longer and longer. And we're going to let our blocks grow, but the blocks do not grow as fast as the length of the polymer. Why are we doing this? This limit will mean a polymer spends a long time in a pair of blocks. So in each pair, there is some self-averaging hopefully going on. At the same time, it is still visiting many, many blocks. So there should also be some self-averaging going on the block level. So by taking this limit, and it doesn't matter how you do it, these two things are necessary and sufficient. You make a separation between a polymer scale, which is the microscopic lattice scale, and an emulsion scale because you have large blocks. And this is fair because droplets would be very, very large compared to a typical monomer. So that's the model that we're looking at, and that's the model of which we would like to be able to say something intelligible, because we think that this is a very rudimentary yet to some extent fair model of the situation that we wanted to describe. The polymer is not going to have?
It's going through many drops.
Oh yes, and it can go through many water blocks, many oil blocks. The blocks are there, and because I'm assuming this, it will indeed see many, many blocks because it's much longer than a typical block size. Okay. So now I'm going to write down as a starting point some formula for the free energy. And it will be a variational formula for the free energy, which is just going to be a starting point of the analysis. And the idea is that because of this specific limit that we're taking, that we're separating a polymer scale and an emulsion scale, that we're actually able to write down an intelligible formula for the free energy, which will be on the next slide. And in order to do that, I need a couple of ingredients. So you have to bear with me to read this, and then when you see the next slide, you will see the variational formula and understand where it comes from. There's first of all, we're going to have four types of blocks. There's blocks A, B, B, A, 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 and B, B. And for each block, we will have to keep track of how much time the polymer spends in this block. On the scale ln, and that will be four numbers for each of the four pairs. And there's a set of 2x2 matrices whose elements are equal to at least equal to 2. Then we're going to need to keep track of how I go through the blocks, and there is a percolation quantity which is a set depending on my parameter p. It's a set of all 2x2 matrices that occur as limiting frequencies of the way in which a path can sort of see these blocks. So this path would mean I got in here, I got out there, in between I could have done all sorts of things, but this arrow means you got out there and not there. This arrow means you got out there, etc., etc. So along this path, which is a coarse-grained path that only looks at when I hit the corners, this part corresponds to the polymer living in a BB block. This piece corresponds to the polymer living in an AA block. this polymer, this piece corresponds to the polymer living in an BA block, because it's crossing a B block and not the A block. And this piece corresponds to the polymer crossing an AB block. So every coarse grain path, which is just keeping track of the corners that I visit, comes with a certain frequency at which it sees these four possible pairs of blocks. And this set is saying, in a typical medium, in a quench typical medium, what are all the possible limiting frequencies that I could possibly have of seeing these blocks. This is a difficult quantity. We don't know exactly what this is, but it's well defined, and it will turn out that we don't actually need to know so much about it. So this is a quantity coming from how you sample a percolation configuration along a certain set. And then what we need as a last ingredient is, when you move in a BB block like here, or in an AA block here, then what is the free energy associated with the polymer in this pair of blocks? So this is a problem about a pair of blocks, and there is a certain free energy for every pair of block that will depend on my interaction parameters, and that will also depend on how much time I spend in this block, because if I'm this directed self-framework, I can still decide how much time I want to spend in this block before I go out. So these are four quantities: a very simple one, keeping track of times; a percolation object telling me how I sort of sample blocks; and then a free energy associated with each single block pair. And once I have those objects, which I can, they are well defined, I can write down a variational formula. And this will be sort of the most difficult object for you to look at today. And here's the theorem that says, yes, the free energy exists. It is self-averaging both with respect to the randomness along the polymer and the medium. It's non-random. And you can write down a variational formula in terms of the three objects that I've just introduced. Namely, you look at all possible pairs of blocks. K and L are both running over A and B. You look at the free energies in the four possible pairs. If you spend a time of amount AKL times the block size in it, well, this would be the total free energy. And if you keep track of the frequencies at which I visit the block, then the total free energy will just be the sum of the free energies of the four pairs of blocks weighted with these possible frequencies, and you have to divide by the total time you spend in it, because F is supposed to be the free energy per step. So this is some variational formula of which it's important that you understand the structure, but these objects are quite difficult to study. And you can vary over all frequencies, because the coarse grain path, since it lives on a much larger scale, it doesn't really carry entropy in the limit of large blocks, and you can still optimize over the times. So what this story says is, if you know this set, which is a percolation quantity, and you have understood how the free energy works in a pair of blocks, then if you would have these ingredients, then you could pull out information of the free energy through this variational problem. Now, we're not going to be able to solve this variational problem, but we can work with it mathematically. So let's have a look at these two ingredients that we need. How about the free energy in a block pair? Well, if you're living in an AA block, there is no interface, and everywhere you go you see only oil, so the free energy of an AA block is very simple. You can compute it. Half of the monomers are in the right medium, and there's some entropy associated with crossing the block. This is something that you can compute. I won't write it down here. And similarly, if you are living in a BB block, there is no interface, and everything is B, and that free energy you can just compute by hand. Okay, now if you're living in an AB block or a BA block, then life becomes interesting, because then there is an interface. And if you're a copolymer and you'd like to live in the neighborhood of an interface, you'll take advantage of that. So what happens is that for the free energy in an AB block, and similarly in a BA block, there's a similar formula, I can write down some variational formula again in terms of something that is computable, that has something to do with entropies, and something that has to do with a free energy of a linear interface. And let me show the picture here. If I am in an AB block, then the polymer could decide to just run up the corner here and completely ignore this part of the block. It could also decide to sort of wiggle around the interface and say, hey, I like so much, my interaction is so strong, I like to sort of localize around the interface, but eventually I will just have to go off and meet my destination here, which is this corner outside. So I could play with these two possibilities, and by, you know, optimizing over how long this piece is and how much time I use to take this, to follow this piece as so this piece means that I'm just wiggling around the interface, and how much time I can cross to use up here, I'm having a variational formula which contains a piece that has to do with the entropy of going up diagonally, and there is a piece that is something that is a linear interface. Again, it's not important that you understand, that you see the fine details of this, but the message of this is that this free energy comes about because you can decide to either run along the interface or not, and if you do, you pick up a linear interface free energy. Now, what is important about this is that this puts us back into the world of linear interfaces. And that's nice, because about linear interfaces we know a lot. So if I would be clever enough to pull out, you know, using the existing knowledge that we have, to pull out information about a linear interface, think that I could stick this in this variational formula and obtain information about my block free energy. So that's the idea. So here, the link with the single free energy interface, about which we have developed over the years so much knowledge, is very important, because now everything boils down to understanding this object, even though it does run over two variational problems which you have to deal with. So that is the idea. You first keep track of the blocks that you visit. That has its own optimization aspect. It has a percolation type of aspect. Then in each of the four types of blocks, you try to understand the copolymer problem, and you can run along the interface for a while and then go up, and therefore you have some optimization over how long you wish to run along this interface, and that is a linear interface problem. So through these two variational problems, we've basically related our free energy to the free energy of a linear interface, and therefore gotten back to the world that we know very well. About the percolation set, we don't need to know so much. All we need to know is that there is a critical number, which is the critical threshold for directed percolation on the square lattice, which is about 0.64. And if you're above this, then the oil percolates, and if you wish, you can spend all your time in the oil. That's what this picture is saying. And if the oil does not percolate, well, then you cannot spend all your time in the oil, and this curve is giving you the maximal amount of time that you could spend in the oil if you were trying for the best possible path. We don't know exactly what this curve looks like, even for directed percolation on the square lattice, but we certainly know that it qualitatively looks like this, and this is in fact all that we will need. So let me go and now tell you what the results are. There is a difference between a supercritical regime and a subcritical regime. If you take P larger than PC, then what happens is that the oil percolates. So I have somewhere an infinite cluster of oil, and because of my restriction of the parameters where alpha was bigger than beta, the polymer prefers to be in the oil rather than in the water, or at least it likes it as much. And so in this oil percolation strategy, I can either decide to spend all my time in the oil, or if I like an interface, I can sort of wiggle around the interface because it's always there. So in this case, I would expect that I get a behavior sort of similar to what I have when I have a linear interface, except the interface is not linear, but it is at least when the oil percolates, there is an infinite interface there which the copolymer can always use. And playing with these two variational formulas, there is a certain criterion for localization that you can formulate in terms of your single interface free energy. I will not be able to explain to you where this comes from, but the message is that there is a certain criteria directly in terms of the single interface free energy that allows you to decide whether your copolymer in the oil percolation regime is actually localizing or not. And the phase diagram looks like this. In the alpha-beta plane, here's the cone. So I need really only look in this cone. The rest can all be gotten through symmetry. Is that there is a critical curve running like this. Below this critical curve, I'm delocalized, meaning that I decide to spend all my time deep inside the infinite cluster of the oil. Whereas if I'm above this curve, I decide to wiggle around the boundary of the oil cluster because I like being in the neighborhood of an interface. And there is a little flat piece here because if I want to run along the interface and I like that, it needs to be rewarding enough, because if I run along the interface, I'm going to lose a little bit of entropy because I will have to go up steeper later. And that is what is responsible for this little linear piece here. So we have a fairly simple phase diagram, and the free energy is a very simple function of alpha and beta in this regime, and it is a complicated function in this regime. We know that it is larger than the free energy in the delocalized regime. So this is very similar to what we know from a flat interface, because in this big percolating oil cluster, it has an infinite interface, even though it's not flat. So in spirit, it's sort of very similar. Now, with Nicolas, we managed to prove that this curve is strictly increasing, so that indeed this curve is sort of is not doing a very degenerate behavior. We were able to prove that the phase transition on this piece here is second order. Here it is first order. Here it is second order. And this is nice because for linear interfaces, we know that the phase transition is at least second order. And we have trouble trying to prove that it is second order. Here in this model for a particular somewhat deeper reason, we're actually able to prove that the order is 2. And moreover, we're able to prove that throughout this whole region of localization, the free energy is infinitely differentiable. So here it is, of course, infinitely differentiable because it's a very simple function, but throughout this whole region is infinitely differentiable. So this really is the only phase transition curve. There isn't anything here that we could have missed in our analysis. So this more or less wraps up the story for the supercritical regime. Now in the subcritical regime, there's a surprise coming up. And the reason is that the phase diagram turns out to be remarkably complicated. In fact, Stu and I were struggling over this for a long time, and about every week we had another guess of what the phase diagram would look like. So Stu at some point would say, this is interesting, we have a phase diagram that depends on time. Well, I thought maybe that's due to aging phenomenon, or at least our aging phenomenon. But so let me show you what happens. If you're below PC, then the oil is no longer percolating. So you do not have the option of diving into your preferred medium and spending all your time there, or spending all your time next to an interface between oil and water that is always there. No. The oil droplets do not percolate, and you have to occasionally go through water, even if you don't like it. And it turns out that there are three critical curves and two tricritical points. So let me show you the picture here. Again, it's the cone that we are interested in. And there are now four different phases. Two delocalized phases and two localized phases. Both delocalized phases are phases where you do not spend any appreciable time close to the interface, and both localized phases are phases where you do spend some time near the interface, but in a different way. And we had a very hard time trying to guess what this looks like, and in fact we were very surprised by the shape of this thing. In the beginning, we thought that this curve should sort of run like that, and then it was a real sort of challenge to figure out what was going on. Now, let me give you pictures of what is happening in these four phases. So, in the first delocalized phase, in an A-B block, you completely spend all your time in the A block. And that's the same in a B block. In the BA block, when you cross the B block, you spend all your time in the B block. So you're completely delocalized. No, you don't want to spend any time near the interface. In the other delocalized phase, what you do is that when you cross a B block, which you occasionally have to do because you have to cross water blocks, you will occasionally dip into the A phase, but deep. You will not do this by staying close to the interface. You will just go away deep into the A and then at some point come back. So this is a peculiar phase where you will pick up the presence of the A, but not by wiggling around the interface, but just by going deep inside. So again, here almost no time spent near the interface. In the first localized phase, when you cross an A block, you will completely not spend any time in the B, but if you cross a B block, you will spend some time crossing the interface with the A block as well. And so you localize only in one of the two blocks that have an interface. Whereas in the second localized phase, so the one where the alpha and the beta are the largest, you spend time along the interface in both types of blocks. So these are pictures of what the path is doing in each of these four cases. And that's much more richer than in the supercritical phase, because then you are only spending all your time in the A blocks or some time across the interface, and there wasn't anything else that you could do. So this is a very somewhat surprising phase diagram. We're not yet able to say a lot about these curves. We think that the phase transition here is second order. Here it is at least second order. We have no idea what the phase transition should be here. Here we even have trouble proving that this line actually exists. So the existence of this line has not yet been proved, but it's pretty obvious that it's there, and maybe someday we will. We're able to prove that you are C infinity in both these delocalized phases, but we are not yet able to prove that you would be C infinity in these two phases. In neither of these phases is the free energy any simple function. It is a complicated function in all of the four phases, and that's why it's so hard to prove that you have a phase transition. In this supercritical case, on one side of the phase diagram, the energy was simple, and on the other side, it was complicated. But all you had to prove was that it not equal to the simple version. Here, it's harder because nowhere is it easy, and to make a distinction is a challenge, and that is what took us so very long to understand. So here again are these four types of possible strategies in this subcritical regime, and here is an artist's impression of what that would be. In the delocalized regime, you spend all your time happily deep inside the oil and the water. You completely ignore the interface. In this region, you when once you sort of hit the water, you will occasionally sort of dip down into the oil to pick up a little bit of interface here, but you sort of go still deep into these droplets. Here you will localize along one type of interface. When you come from the water into the oil, you localize, but you don't localize in another fashion, whereas here you try to localize both from the inside and from the outside. So if you come from within a droplet or from without droplet, you will try to localize. So these are four types of behavior that occur in this subcritical phase that we, after a long struggle and respecting the unforgiving rules of mathematics, have been able to prove that this is occurring. So somewhat of a surprise. It's nice that we've been able to pull to the surface some of these nice aspects of this polymer in an emulsion model. That, after all, was our goal, to see can we do anything to describe such an emulsion type of model, even though it's very stylized and with blocks and all sorts of restrictions that we put in the model. It's nice that it has this richness, which captures at least some of the facets of this whole story. And so indeed, this was great fun to do with Stu. Thank you very much, Stu. I hope we will continue indefinitely talking about polymers. So thank you very much, Ray. Thank you for your company when I was in Toronto. It's always been nice to visit the department, and this has been a nice conference. We take home something to think about and a big smile. Thank you.